This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 16th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tomos Lewis. Today is our final theatre review of the year, so of course we've invited in Monocle 24 friend and critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe. On the show today, we'll be rounding up some of London's latest productions, including Sheridan Smith's latest role in a new production of World War I musical Funny Girl. We'll find out if Tom Stoppard's spy thriller Hapgood is more of a hit in 2015 than it was all the way back in 1988, and we'll end with some festive viewing as Jim Broadbent takes up the role of Ebenezer Scrooge in Charles Dickens' classic tale of Greed and Ghosts, A Christmas Carol. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review here on Monocle 24. Matt, a very warm welcome to the show. Thank you for joining
us. It's
a
pleasure.
And Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year to you.
Nice to end on a flourish theatrically here on the Arts Review. Yes. We're going to get the programme going with a look at the Meunier Chocolate Factory, where a remake of the musical Funny Girl has hit the stage, starring the British actress Sheridan Smith. Mm-hmm. Remind us briefly, this is obviously one of the big dogs, I suppose, of the musical theatre world. Give us a quick rundown of the story.
Yeah, well, it's a curious one, this, because it's a very well-known title, but it's a show that most people haven't seen. So they know about it, but they don't know it. The reason they know about it is it's the show that really put Barbara Streisand on the map. First on Broadway in 1964, and then, believe it or not, in London in 1966, and then she did the movie of it, and she won the Oscar for Best Actress in 1968. So it was her sort of career-transforming role. She plays the part of Fanny Bryce. Fanny Bryce was, I mean, has been no longer living for a long time, but she was a very established actress, singer, comedian in America in the first half of the 20th century, who was funny but also vocally very gifted. And the show really tells about her rise and rise, set against her romantic travails with a chap called Nicky Arnstein, who, if people saw the film, it was the role played in the movie by Omar Sharif. So that's the story. It's a pretty slender story, to be honest, but it's an opportunity for a leading actress to have a field day.
And what kind of field day does Sheridan Smith have in the role then, in your view?
Well, the interesting thing is that the show has never been revived on Broadway since the original production or in London until now. And I think that's because for decades, literally, people have been thinking, who could possibly follow in the heels of Streisand? And you couldn't find somebody more different from Barbara Streisand than Sheridan Smith. She's not American, she's not Jewish, and she doesn't have a powerhouse singing voice. What she does have that Streisand doesn't and didn't is unbelievable charm and empathy. She's just one of these people, and you don't learn this in drama school. She's just one of these people who audiences love. And she has this gift no matter whether she's doing Terence Rattigan, which she has done, won an Olivier Award, or Little Shop of Horrors, the musical. She comes on stage and people warm to her. You can feel the audience lean forward. And that's very, very important in a show like this, where since Fanny is kind of the ugly duckling from a sort of squawking Jewish family, and she wants to be a big star, but nobody believes in her except her. And then she falls under the sway of this impossibly smooth guy, Nicky Arnstein, who turns out to be perhaps not quite as good as he looks. Nobody could. So she's got these two things going on, her fame and her love life. But basically, the story is one of these self-empowerment stories told across, I think it's 13 songs that Fanny sings. That's a lot of songs for one character in a musical, a lot. And Streisand, I didn't see her in the show, obviously. I was barely around then. But I saw her in the film, and obviously she gets it in the film, but you can start in a movie. Sheridan Smith has to pace herself, because otherwise she'd blow her voice out after the first number. So she doesn't sort of go for the big Bravura money notes, but what she does is, cleverly, she acts the songs incredibly well, and she makes you feel feel the songs. So when she sings that famous Streisand number, People, People Who Need People Are the Luckiest People in the World, Streisand sort of sings it as this great sort of power ballad. And actually, Sheridan Smith sings it as something much quieter and more introspective and very yearning. And at the end of it, I can guarantee you no one at the Minier has a dry eye. So that's the kind of performance you're getting.
And is that a summary, I suppose, as well, of the adaptation itself? What kind of reinterpretation of this?
Well, you know, they made a bit of a fuss about how Harvey Fierstein, who's the Broadway-winning writer and actor as well, had tweaked the script for this. I don't think the tweaks are all that important. It's really just a character study in Fanny. I think the problem with the show, and probably why it won't be revived for another 50 years, so I doubt I'll be around to see the next one, is it's not really about very much. I mean, we know that Fanny's Rise and Rise is going to happen. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a show. And you sort of don't want her to get together with Nicky, even though you know that she will. And that's it. There's not much at stake. So really what you're listening to essentially is a series of wonderful songs reinterpreted by an actress first and a singer second. And that works on its own terms. I think the production is a little bit cramped at the Minier, but they've already announced that it's moving in April to the Savoy Theatre on the West End. So maybe it will blossom there.
A bit more breathing space.
Quite a lot more breathing space.
Well, from one revival to another, as we move seamlessly on, Matt. We're going now to the Hampstead Theatre, which I think I haven't been there for a while, but that has a bit of breathing room, I believe.
Yeah, it does. It does.
And currently staged there is a spy thriller called Hapgood. Now, this is written by Oscar and Tony Award-winning playwright Sir Tom Stoppard,
yes,
of course.
Yes.
First production of the play in 1990. It was a critical failure, frankly.
Yeah,
How did they get on with it this time around?
Well, I've sort of tracked this play across all of its various iterations, and this production is far better than the earlier London production in every possible way. And a little bit like Funny Girl, but I think more dramatically in the case of Hapgood, they've gone back to the well. And the thing with this, which wasn't an issue with Funny Girl, is how to make it clear. One of the issues always with Tom Stoppard is you have a great time or not, but at the end you scratch your head and you think, well, what was that about? What happened? How's he related to her? Oh, they're supposed to be twins? And what was that big speech about electrons and particle physics actually saying? Oh, I missed that bit. So what Stoppard has realized as he hurtles towards 80, is, as he puts it, the drip of information is very important for the public, which is true. And, you know, audiences like to have some idea what's going on. So he's taken this story of a woman called Elizabeth Hapgood, beautifully played by Lisa Dillon, who is a big deal in British intelligence. And she has a lover who's a Russian double agent, but maybe he's a triple agent, and maybe he's a quadruple agent. And so there's a whole thing going on there involving various stings and bluffs and counter bluffs in the world of espionage. But at the same time, on the domestic front, she's a mum. Hapgood is a mum. And she has a young son who's at boarding school and who likes nothing more than playing rugby of an afternoon. And this is very important to Hapgood. She wants to be a good mother. She also wants to be a good, you know, agent. So can she juggle these two? And the net result of all this is that the play has kind of found a heart that it didn't have before. And it's really well directed by Howard Davis, almost as if it were a movie. Wonderfully fluid projections at the back of the stage, a quick cinematic cross-cutting. And one of the interesting things about Stoppard's plays is that actually relatively few of them have ever been filmed. And I wonder if Stoppard, looking at this production, thinks, actually, this could work as a movie. It really could.
And what else is happening on stage? How have they constructed these dual worlds, I suppose?
Well, the opening scene, for instance, and if you look at it on the page, you might think, what in heaven's name could this possibly be, because it's just a couple of pages of stage directions, but it's in a public men's changing room at so people coming in after a swim or whatever to change, and you see all these anonymous men coming on in trench coats with briefcases and very important looking documents delivered by very important looking men, and they're sliding one briefcase under a door and then another one, and there's a whole thing going on with towels, and the whole thing seems to be an elaborate subterfuge to try and catch out an agent at his own game. But the question is, which side is he on? And then there's an interesting question about at least two of the characters as to whether they are only one character or do they in fact contain their own twin? It sounds preposterous, but it actually works well in the watching of it, because they have monitored the telling of it minute by minute, scene by scene, emotion by emotion. That's what this production does very well, is give you a pulse to something that could just be a head trip.
And in terms of, just briefly, the drip, as you say, of the storytelling, of the telling of a tale, do you think that the combination of, say, the visual trickery, but also the Stoppard's plot, Stoppard's storytelling himself, does that shine in this revival?
Well, you know what's interesting about it is when I've seen the play before, I thought it was almost like an inadvertent parody of a John le Carré novel. Now it seems to be a play, unexpectedly, about how you reassemble a family. And I probably shouldn't say much more than that, because there's a little bit of a surprise embedded in that statement that I wouldn't want to give away.
Well, we shall keep the guessing game going then, Matt, as we hurtle towards Christmas, of course, and to one of the big name kind of performances, I suppose, this festive season. I mean, British audiences will be very familiar with the pantomime, I suppose, when lots of, stars from times past populate the stages of these fair isles. Jim Broadbent, this is not a pantomime at all.
No.
He is in a Christmas production, and he is performing rather a fantastic role, performing it very well.
Yeah, I mean, he's playing Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, the interesting thing about that is, second only to Sheridan Smith, Jim Broadbent is probably the other performer in Britain who inspires immediate affection and adoration from an audience. I mean, everything about him is lovable. When he won the Oscar for Iris, he gave the sweetest acceptance speech in Oscar memory. He's just a good guy. So to see him playing, you know, this famous bah humbug who doesn't want to partake in any of the festive season cheer is sort of surprising. But of course, that's why you become an actor, in the same way that Sheridan is playing Fanny Bryce. You want to play somebody different to you. And rather like Sheridan Smith, Jim Broadbent succeeds triumphantly. I think Jim Broadbent's trump card are his eyes, because even when Ebenezer Scrooge is at his most dyspeptic and laying waste to the world around him, and he doesn't want anything to do with Bob Cratchit, and he doesn't want to see his nephew and all of that, but something about the eyes suggests to you that there's another narrative in him waiting to be revealed. And that isn't, well, we all know the story, that is in fact what happens by the end of it, where he's kind of emotionally brought to the table, literally brought to the table, so he can partake of the turkey. After this production is quite strong in the psychoanalytics. Why did Ebenezer Scrooge end up the way he did? Was it because of this love affair gone awry? Something in his past? You know, is his loneliness something that he actually wants, or is this something that he's been landed with? And it suggests that actually all of us want our place at the table. And Jim Broadbent charts that very, very well. It's directed by a longtime colleague of his, Philip McDermid, and written by Patrick Barlow, with whom Jim Broadbent used to have a tiny little theater company called the National Theater of Brent. So he's surrounded himself with friends. It feels like he's gone back to the table theatrically. And I don't know if it's the tightest production in town. It seemed to me to end about four times. But on its own terms, it's very, very winning. And I think people who go will have a good time.
To go back to Jim Broadbent briefly, he is undoubtedly, I think, one of the UK's most celebrated character actors specifically. I wonder, when you take on a role like Ebenezer Scrooge, that is one of those universal characters that everybody knows or have some sort of reference point to, the way you were describing the emotional depth, I suppose, to Broadbent's rendition of Ebenezer Scrooge, how refreshing and new, in terms of the context of this work, did that feel to you?
It felt very refreshing and new to me, but you know, I thought about it, and actually, although this is such a time-honored title, I don't know that I've seen that many versions of A Christmas Carol, certainly on stage. Patrick Stewart had a great sort of success in London and on Broadway, basically just reading it. I mean, from memory, it was a phenomenal feat. And that was great. But there's something about having it brought to life with a stage full of other people, admittedly fewer people than you might think, The supporting cast, I think, is 4 or 5 actors. It seems like more because they all double and triple. There's a lot of stuff. They have a lot of fun with the stagecraft itself, you know. Oh, snow. Well, let's just pour the confetti on you as you walk into the studio. That kind of thing. So you're looking at the mechanics of theater making. They're playing with the artifice of it so that at the same time you can feel the truth of this one character's transformation just in time for the Christmas season. And there's a sweet little note in the program where Jim Broadbent says he wants audiences to leave the Noel Coward Theater ready to embrace life and ready to embrace the holiday season. And I think you actually do. It isn't just lip service. You really do feel that.
Well, a cheering note to end on. No bar humbugs anywhere in sight.
Not at all.
Matt Wolfe, thank you so much for joining us here on this edition of the Monocle Arts Review for our final theatrical review of the year. Very much look forward to speaking to you again in the new year to come. And that does bring this edition of the Monocle Arts Review to an end with me, Tomos Lewis. The producer of today's extravaganza was the very festive Holly Fisher. The Monocle Arts Review returns at the same time tomorrow for our final book review of 2015. That will be with the ever lovely Kathy Retzenbrink. But for now, from me, Tomos Lewis, and everyone here at the Monocle Arts Review, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.